Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're taking a fascinating journey into the world of innovative insurance solutions, specifically in developing economies.
Yeah, and we're using this really comprehensive report as our guide, Global Insurance Innovations Risk Management for Sustainable Development.
Right. And our goal, our sort of mission for this deep dive, is to get a real handle on how these new approaches are making insurance actually work, how it's becoming accessible in places where it, well, hasn't been before.
Exactly. How they're overcoming those traditional roadblocks, you know, and ultimately how this all ties into economic development for people and whole communities in low and middle income countries.
And this report, it's pretty packed, covers a lot of ground.
Oh, definitely. Everything from the basics, the sort of principles of microinsurance, all the way to disaster risk financing, which is quite cutting edge, and the huge role digital tech is playing.
You know, one thing that really jumped out at me right away was just the sheer scale of the insurance gap.
It's staggering, isn't it? The report says in developing countries, something like 95% of losses from disasters just go uninsured.
95%? Wow.
Yeah. Compare that to high-income countries, where it's closer to maybe 50%. It just shows the huge disparity.
And you can immediately see the knock-on effects, can't you?
Totally. The report touches on this. Farmers might stick to low-risk crops because they can't afford a loss. Businesses hold back on investment.
Families might be saving every penny defensively instead of, say, investing in education. It really holds back progress.
And that's a key point we need to keep in mind. These innovations, they aren't just scaled-down versions of the insurance we might be familiar with.
Right. It's more fundamental than that.
Exactly. It's a genuine rethinking of how insurance can work, designed specifically for the unique circumstances and challenges found in these economies.
Okay, so let's dive into that. To really get why these innovations are so important, we probably need to first understand what makes risks so different in developing economies.
Precisely. It's not just that the risks hit harder, although they often do. The whole risk landscape is, well, different. The report calls it the amplified impact of risk.
Amplified impact.
Oh.
Okay, what does that mean in practice?
Well, think about a financial shock, maybe a $500 medical bill. In a wealthier context, that's difficult, maybe, but probably manageable.
Right.
But for a family living near subsistence level, that same $500 can be absolutely catastrophic. It could mean selling off their only cow or pulling a child out of school. Really devastating choices.
The report had that really stark example from rural Cambodia.
Yeah, that was powerful. Health shocks were the leading cause of families falling into poverty there. And get this, 67% of those hit by serious illness had to sell assets, like land or livestock,
right,
just to pay for care.
67%, that's how you get stuck in a poverty trap, isn't it? One health crisis and you've lost your productive asset.
Exactly. So in seemingly small shocks can have these huge, long-lasting consequences.
And it's not just individual shocks, is it? There's this other type of risk.
Right. Covariate risk and systemic vulnerability. That's the jargon, but it basically means events that hit whole communities or regions all at once. Think widespread droughts, floods.
Things that affect everyone in an area simultaneously.
Precisely. And climate-related risks are a huge factor here, obviously. Many developing countries are geographically vulnerable, and their economies often depend heavily on climate-sensitive sectors like agriculture.
The World Bank figure was pretty striking, something like $18 billion in annual losses just from infrastructure damage due to weather disasters.
Yeah, $18 billion a year in low and middle income countries. And that's just infrastructure damage. It doesn't even count the wider economic impact or the human cost.
Then there's the whole data issue.
Ah, yes. Information asymmetries and data limitations. Traditional insurance relies heavily on good data, knowing the likelihood of risks, the value of what's being insured, confirming when events happen.
And that data is often just missing or unreliable.
Often, yeah. Very scarce or patchy. Which makes the standard ways of calculating premiums and assessing risk really difficult, sometimes impossible.
The report also mentioned the difference between urban and rural risks.
Good point. You see different profiles. In rapidly growing urban informal settlements, maybe more risks around insecure housing, environmental hazards. In rural areas, it's often dominated by agricultural risks, weather, pests, crop prices.
Which makes a one-size-fits-all insurance product pretty tricky.
Very tricky. And on top of that, we absolutely have to consider gender. The report stresses the need for gender-sensitive insurance approaches.
Meaning?
Well, women often face different types of risks compared to men, and they can face specific barriers in just accessing financial services, including insurance. So products and how they're delivered need to account for that.
So it's this really complex, dynamic picture. Urbanization, tech changes, climate change, globalization, it's all shaping this unique risk environment.
Exactly. And it's out of this complex environment that microinsurance really emerged.
Okay, microinsurance. We hear the term a lot. But what is it, fundamentally? Is it just small insurance policies?
That's a common misconception, but no, it's much more than that. It's not just miniaturized insurance. It's really a distinct approach designed from the ground up to reach low-income people who've been excluded from the traditional market.
So how would you define it then?
Well, the consultative group to assist the CORE, CGAP, they define it pretty clearly. It's the protection of low-income people against specific perils in exchange for regular premium payments proportionate to the likelihood and cost of the risk involved.
Proportionate payments, specific perils.
Okay. The core idea is the same pooling risk, but how it's done is radically different. It has to be given the context we just discussed,
right?
Limited data, low financial literacy, irregular incomes, sometimes weak institutions, dispersed populations.
Right, all those challenges.
There's a great quote in the report from a loan officer at BRSH in Bangladesh. They tried offering life insurance to their microcredit clients, and they basically said everything had to change.
Everything. Like what?
How they explained it, how they collected the tiny premiums, how they verified claims when people often don't have formal death certificates, how they paid out benefits. The whole process needed a complete rethink.
So what are some of these key adaptations? Simplicity seems like it would be crucial.
Absolutely. Product simplicity and transparency is paramount. Policies need to be straightforward, easy to grasp.
Got an example?
Yeah, the PISO hospitalization insurance in the Philippines. It pays a fixed amount of cash for each day you're in the hospital for any reason. Simple. You know exactly what you get. Less confusion, fewer disputes.
Makes sense. And affordability, obviously, is huge. How do they tackle that?
Several innovative approaches to affordability.
Mm-hmm.
One is premium financing. Pioneer Life, also in the Philippines, lets people pay premiums in small, weekly installments. Much easier than a big annual lump sum.
Okay, breaking it down.
Then there's premium fragmentation. Bima's mobile insurance is a classic example. Premiums as low as 30 cents a month, just deducted from your phone's airtime. Tiny, frequent payments fit better with tight, irregular budgets.
Wow, 30 cents.
Yeah. And finally, group pricing. Signing people up through existing organizations, cooperatives, community groups, creates a larger pool and can bring the per-person premium down significantly.
So it's not just cheaper insurance, it's structured differently to match how people manage money.
Exactly. Tiny, frequent payments, that's a key insight. It overcomes a massive barrier.
Okay, so you've designed an affordable, simple product.
Yeah.
How do you actually reach people? You mentioned traditional brokers often aren't the answer.
Right. Alternative distribution channels are essential. They're leveraging existing networks, microfinance institutions, MFIs, farmer cooperatives, women's groups, religious organizations, places people already trust and interact with.
Using existing infrastructure.
Precisely. And mobile phones, as we mentioned, are a massive channel. Bima, Microinsure, they've reached millions this way. We also see partnerships with retail outlets like Hollard Insurance selling through Pipa stores in South Africa.
Retail stores. Interesting.
Even utility companies. La Equidad in Colombia lets customers add premiums to their electricity bills. It's about meeting people where they are.
Sounds like a win-win-win. The insurer gets market access, the partner adds value, and the customer gets protection.
It often is. The report mentions Cash Foundation in Pakistan partnering with Jubilee Insurance for health cover for microcredit clients. Cash sees fewer loan defaults because clients can cope with health shocks. Jubilee gets access to a huge, previously untapped market.
Okay, but collecting those tiny, maybe irregular premiums still sounds challenging, especially if people don't have bank accounts.
It is, which is why innovative premium collection is vital. Mobile network operators are key, like Microinsure in Ghana deducting for mobile credit.
Right, the airtime deduction again.
Cooperatives like SIA in India might collect small cash amounts during regular member meetings. For agricultural insurance, sometimes the premium is embedded in the price of seeds or fertilizer.
Oh, clever.
Or deducted from the payment a farmer receives when they sell their crops.
Okay, got it. So product, affordability, distribution, collection. What about when someone actually needs to make a claim? That seems like another potential bottleneck.
Claims processing has also seen a lot of innovation, much of it tech-driven. Mobile money is huge claims directly to someone's phone is fast and efficient.
M-Pesa and similar platforms.
Exactly. Sometimes there's direct payment to service providers, paying the hospital or the funeral home directly. And then you have the automated index-based payouts we touched on earlier.
Like the Kilima Salama example in Kenya.
Yes, ACRE Africa's program. Rainfall drops below a certain level, boom, automatic payout triggered via SMS to farmers and PISA accounts. No lengthy assessments needed. Super efficient.
It all sounds incredibly logical and efficient on paper, but insurance is about trust, isn't it? How do you build that, especially with something new and maybe abstract?
Building trust and understanding is absolutely critical. It doesn't happen overnight. Several strategies are key.
Like what?
Well, demonstration through early claims payment is huge. When people see their neighbors actually getting paid quickly when something happens, that builds massive confidence.
Social proof.
Exactly. Community-based education, often using respected local figures, teachers, community leaders to explain how it works, is also vital. And technology helps here too, using simple videos, interactive voice response, IVR systems, apps, and local languages.
That CARD MBA finding was amazing. Clients who saw neighbors get claims were 5 times more likely to renew.
5 times. It shows how powerful that visible proof is. In supporting all this, we're seeing regulatory innovations. Governments are realizing microinsurance needs its own rules.
Not just applying the old rules for big insurance companies.
Right. Creating distinct legal frameworks. Some places are even trying regulatory sandboxes, safe spaces, to test new ideas.
And who are the actual providers? What kinds of organizations are doing this?
There are several institutional models. The partner agent model is common big insurers, partnering with local organizations like MFIs. Then the community-based model, mutuals, cooperatives owned by the members themselves, like CIWA or Uplift. Some large insurers create dedicated full-service microinsurance divisions. There are microinsurance networks for sharing resources and knowledge. And increasingly, the digital platform model, tech companies partnering with licensed insurers.
A real mix, but the economics. Dealing with tiny premiums, remote customers. How do they make it work financially? The economics of microinsurance must be tough.
It's definitely a major challenge. Transaction costs can eat up a big chunk of those small premiums. But they use strategies to cope.
Such as?
Bundling insurance with loans or other services helps spread costs. Technology is key for efficiency. Achieving massive scale is crucial. Sometimes cross-subsidization between different products or customer groups. And very careful product design to keep things simple. And admin costs low.
So it requires a very specific business model.
Yes. The report uses CARD MBA again as an example of viability. Their mandatory enrollment for MFI clients gives them scale, their products are simple, and the integration with the MFI slashes costs.
And does it actually work? Is there evidence of real impact and outcomes?
The evidence base is growing, though there are still gaps. But yes, studies show crucial financial protection. People experience smaller income drops after a shock, rely less on harmful coping strategies like selling assets or pulling kids from school.
That Cambodian example again?
Exactly. There's also evidence that encourages investment and productivity. The report cites insured farmers in Ghana buying 24% more fertilizer and getting 16% higher yields. They felt safer taking that risk.
Higher yields, wow.
And don't underestimate the peace of mind. That psychological benefit of security is really important too. Health microinsurance seems particularly consistent in showing positive effects on accessing care.
And it seems the impact can go beyond risk transfer itself.
Definitely. We see microinsurance integrated with healthcare improvements in Rwanda. Sometimes the platforms are used to deliver farming advice. In Mongolia, the livestock insurance program even helped modernize herding practices.
So looking at the road ahead for microinsurance, what are the main challenges and opportunities now?
Huge opportunity. Still, the untapped market is vast. But the digital divide is a real challenge. Ensuring tech doesn't exclude people. Developing supportive regulations everywhere is key. COVID-19 might have actually increased risk awareness and demand. And we're seeing business models constantly evolving. The potential is there for microinsurance to go from niche to mainstream.
It's a really dynamic space. Okay, let's pivot slightly and look specifically at innovations in life and health microinsurance. As you said, these often cover the most catastrophic risks for poor households.
They really do. A major illness or the death of a breadwinner can be utterly devastating financially. The case studies here are fascinating. Let's start with Bima again, leveraging mobile technology for scale.
We talked about their premium fragmentation. What else made them successful?
Their whole model was built around the mobile phone. That vision of using mobile tech to reach the underserved was central. The micro deductions from airtime were key for affordability, but they also built a large network of local agents.
Agents, so not purely digital.
No, and that's important. agents used mobile tech for registration, but crucially, they provided that human touch, education, and trust building on the ground.
What do they offer initially?
Started simple, basic life insurance, streamlined claims. Then they expanded hospitalization cover, critical illness, even telemedicine services. Their scale is incredible, over 35 million customers by 2021.
And that COVID example in Ghana was telling.
Yeah, a 60% jump in life claims, all processed remotely, paid via mobile money, show the resilience of their model.
So key principles, tech leverage, human touch, evolving products, partnerships.
Exactly. Challenges remain balancing sustainability and impact, navigating different regulations. But evaluations show they are reaching low income, often first-time insurance buyers. Over 75% were first-timers and nearly half lived on less than $2.50 a day.
Impressive reach. Now, Uplift Mutuals presents a real contrast, doesn't it? Community-owned health protection.
A very different philosophy. Rooted in mutual aid, community ownership. The members are the owners.
How does that change things?
It aligns incentives completely.
Yeah.
Claims are seen as the community supporting its own. It fosters solidarity. Their product design reflects this too flexible cover based on actual treatment costs, affordable premiums, and critically, covering pre-existing conditions and maternity care, which often get excluded elsewhere.
And they use community health workers.
Yes, vital role. They help members navigate the system, negotiate costs, provide health education. Uplift also uses a cashless claim system with a helpline and guarantee letters to hospitals, making it easier for members when they're sick.
What's their impact been like?
Good growth, high renewal rates. Studies show members borrow less, sell fewer assets for healthcare, and tend to seek care earlier.
Key principles seem to be governance alignment, health system integration, prevention focus.
And using technology appropriate to their context. Not just for technology's sake. Their main challenge has been scaling up, which they're tackling through a federation structure to pool resources.
Okay, then Pioneer Microinsurance and their hospital cash products. What's the deal there?
This is a simple, effective model. You get a fixed amount of cash for each day you're hospitalized, period. Doesn't matter what the actual bills are.
Ah, so it bypasses complex medical billing.
Exactly. Easy to understand, gives the customer flexibility on how to use the cash cover bills, lost income, transport, whatever.
Yeah.
Their sickness and accident insurance offers this, distributed through rural banks, MFIs, even pawn shops.
Pawn shops. Interesting channel.
Reaching people where they are. They also have tiered documentation for claims balancing fraud prevention with customer convenience. Impact studies show it helps households avoid desperate measures like pulling kids from school during an illness. And the models spread, Bangladesh, Kenya, are using similar approaches.
Card MBA in the Philippines comes up again, this time for building scale through integration.
Their integration with the card MFI is the absolute key. Their core product is basic life insurance, and it's mandatory for all microfinance clients and their spouses.
Mandatory enrollment, that explains the scale.
Huge risk pool. Avoids adverse selection where only the sickest sign up, slashes marketing costs, integrates premium collection with loan repayments. It's incredibly efficient.
Makes sense.
Premiums are very affordable, and they've built voluntary products on top health, retirement, education plans, their member-owned, use-paid staff, plus volunteer coordinators. Very sustainable model financially.
So the MFI integration is crucial for distribution, trust, client base, even protecting the MFI's own loan portfolio.
All of the above. And they've successfully adapted this model elsewhere, like Cambodia and East Africa. The main limitation is it works best with simple, standardized products, which might not suit everyone perfectly.
Let's talk funerals. A huge expense, especially for poorer families. Tata AIG tackled this.
Yes, pioneering funeral insurance. They saw this specific vulnerability and created a product providing a lump sum just for funeral costs. Their Sampoorna Raksha policy fixed benefit, affordable premium.
What's special about it?
Accelerated claims aiming for 48 hours. And flexible documentation, recognizing formal proof might be hard to get. They distribute through self-help groups and trained micro-agents.
And it had wider impacts.
Interestingly, yes. Beyond the immediate relief, studies found insured households were more likely to invest in agriculture. The model's been picked up in places like South Africa and Ghana, too.
Okay, the freemium model, Telenor and Microinsure. How did that work?
Simple but brilliant. Offer free, basic life insurance linked to mobile airtime spending.
Free? How does that work financially?
Telenor, the mobile operator, benefited from lower customer churn and maybe higher spending. Customers got free protection. Microinsure, the insurer, got access to a massive potential customer base for upgrades later.
Win-win-win again.
Seemed like it. They got huge scale in Pakistan, 4 million enrolled in 18 months. It's a great way to introduce insurance to people with zero prior exposure. And the freemium idea is spreading to other sectors too.
Finally, Sevamob, integrating insurance with primary healthcare.
A really integrated model. They combine insurance with direct healthcare delivery via mobile clinics.
So you get the insurance and the service together.
Yeah, exactly. Advantages are clear. Mm-hmm. Ensures the benefit translates to actual health improvements, builds trust and engagement because people see immediate value from the clinics. They use tech, like tablet diagnostics, telemedicine. Reached over 50,000 people by 2019 with the documented better health outcomes.
Looking ahead here, what's next? Parametric health triggers, AI.
Yeah, the report mentions those.
Yeah.
Parametric triggers based on, say, disease outbreaks, AI for personalized risk assessment, closer integration with social safety nets, layered coverage systems, more ecosystem integration. The potential for life and health microinsurance as a poverty reduction tool is massive, if done right.
Okay, let's shift gears to agriculture. Huge sector. Highly vulnerable to weather. Innovations here must be critical.
Absolutely critical. The report starts with Aissati Diallo in Senegal, a groundnut farmer using index insurance after drought losses. Her story really highlights the vulnerability and the potential of insurance here.
Traditional crop insurance has struggled in these contexts, right? Assessing individual farm losses is costly and complex.
Exactly. Issues like moral hazard farmers maybe not trying as hard if insured in adverse selection, only high-risk farmers buying it are big problems. Plus, the sheer cost of visiting every single farm to assess damage.
So, index insurance. Paying based on triggers is the alternative.
It's the main innovative approach. Payouts aren't based on your specific farm's loss. They're based on an objective, measurable index like rainfall measured at a local weather station, average yields in a district, satellite data on vegetation greenness.
So if the index hits a certain threshold, say rainfall below X millimeters, everyone in that area with the policy gets a payout.
Basically, yes. It bypasses the need for individual loss assessment completely, much faster, cheaper, and less prone to fraud or disputes about damage levels.
How did this whole idea evolve?
The report traces the evolution of index insurance. Early research by people like Peter Hazel and Jerry Skies. Then pilot programs India, Mexico, Ethiopia were early testers.
When did it become more commercial?
The BASICS and ICICI Lombard program in India in 2003 is often cited as one of the first really commercial schemes. Since then, huge interest globally, World Bank support, etc.
What are the big trends now?
Three main things. Technology driving better indices and operations, evolving distribution models using existing networks, seed companies, farmer groups, and clearer roles emerging for public and private sectors.
Let's look at some examples. The R4 Rural Resilience Initiative, Comprehensive Risk Management. What's that about?
R4 is interesting because it's not just insurance. It integrates weather index insurance with improved resource management, microcredit, and savings, bundling services.
And it had that insurance for work link in Ethiopia.
Yeah, initially linked to the Productive Safety Net program. Vulnerable households could earn insurance coverage through labor contributions on public works projects. Very innovative. They also involve farmers in designing the indices.
Has it worked?
Expanded to several countries. Documented impacts on increased savings, investment, food security. Scaling it has been a challenge because it's quite community intensive, but they're working on digitization.
Okay, ACRE Africa. From seeds to satellites. We mentioned their mobile payouts. What else?
Their model often integrates insurance directly with buying inputs like seeds or fertilizer. You buy the seed, you get the insurance, often registered via scratch card and mobile phone.
Streamlined.
Very. Eliminates separate sales, aligns premium payment with planting, allows precise index matching for that location, and enables those rapid mobile money payouts. Rose Guslinga from ACRE talks about the power of automatic claims.
What's their impact?
Significant expansion, evidence of boosting farmer investment and incomes. They're really leveraging tech automated weather stations, mobile registration, satellite data to make the economics work. And they're actively tackling basis risk.
Basis risk of the mismatch problem, right? The index says pay, but my farm was fine, or vice versa.
Exactly. ACRE works on this with dense weather station networks, satellite data, modeling, even a basis risk fund to handle edge cases.
Index insurance isn't just for crops, though. Mongolia.
Right. The index-based livestock insurance in Mongolia shows it works for pastoralists, too. Protects against ZUD, those extreme winters.
What's the index there?
District-level livestock mortality rates, based on official government census data. Clever use of existing data. It's a public-private partnership with layered risk. Nationwide now, proved its worth in the big 2009-10 ZUD.
And the Ghana Agricultural Insurance Pool, GAIP.
That shows structured public-private collaboration. pooling resources from private insurers, government, donors to overcome market fragmentation. Government provides support regulations, weather data, some subsidies, farmer education, reaches over 100,000 farmers a year, positive impacts documented.
Technology seems central to improving these indices.
Hugely. Technology and innovation in index design is making them more accurate, cheaper, and able to cover more areas. Satellite-based remote sensing is massive rainfall estimates, vegetation health, NDVI, soil moisture, all from space.
Companies are specializing in this.
Yeah, the Climate Corporation, WorldCover, using complex data combinations. Indices are getting more sophisticated too, looking at specific crop growth stages, consecutive dry days, using crop model outputs, and mobile tech underpins so much. MPs are for payments, smartphones for enrollment, low-cost weather stations, sending data via cell networks.
But that basis risk problem remains the Achilles heel.
It's a big challenge. That mismatch between the index and the farm reality. Caused by local weather variations, different farming practices, the index just not perfectly correlating.
How are they tackling it beyond what ACRE is doing?
Several approaches. Hybrid indices combine different data sources, maybe satellite NDVI plus local rain gauge data. Gap insurance, supplementary cover for proven losses, even if the index didn't trigger. Audit rules to review index payouts in exceptional cases. Better index granularity using more local data. And crucially, education and communication, so farmers understand what the index does and doesn't cover. Managing expectations is key.
Governments and development partners seem essential here.
Absolutely. The role of governments and development partners is critical. Collaboration is needed. They provide infrastructure, weather networks, data systems, regulations, support research and development, and sometimes offer smart subsidies.
Smart subsidies?
Yeah, targeted, time-limited subsidies. Maybe helping cover setup costs, supporting R&D, or making premiums affordable for the most vulnerable farmers initially, without distorting the market long-term. Approaches vary, but the consensus is against purely market or purely subsidized solutions.
And the overall impact evidence?
Generally positive. We see changes in investment behavior, farmers buying more inputs, better resilience to shocks, maintaining consumption, protecting assets, even improved psychological well-being, less anxiety.
Caveats.
Impact varies by context and design. Most evidence is from specific programs. Long-term impacts, less understood still. It's promising, but not a silver bullet on its own.
So the road ahead here involves more bundling, maybe insuring aggregators, linking to climate adaptation.
Yes, bundled solutions with advice or credit. Meso-level insurance for cooperatives or processors. Climate adaptation integration, payouts linked to resilience investments, more specific regulatory innovation, and broader ecosystem approaches. It's about fitting index insurance into a wider risk management picture.
It definitely sounds like a powerful tool for agriculture, especially with climate change.
Absolutely. Which leads us nicely into the broader topic of disaster risk financing.
Right. Moving beyond just agriculture to managing the financial fallout from major disasters, earthquakes, hurricanes, widespread floods. The report starts with Haiti in 2010.
A stark reminder. The earthquake hit, devastation was immense, but the international aid response was tragically slow in delivering funds where they were needed. Underscores the need for pre-planned finance.
Which is what disaster risk financing, DRF, is all about.
Exactly. Setting up financial mechanisms before disaster strikes so that when it does, funds are available quickly and predictably, not waiting for aid appeals. Instruments include catastrophe insurance, risk pools, special credit lines, catastrophe bonds.
Like the Caribbean Catastrophe Risk Insurance Facility, CCRIF.
A prime example, born out of the terrible 2004 hurricane season. Key innovations. Risk pooling across multiple Caribbean and Central American countries spreads the risk.
And they use those parametric triggers too.
Yes, parametric insurance triggers. Payouts based on measured hazard intensity, wind speed, ground shaking, rainfall, not damage assessment, allows for very fast payouts, often within weeks. They also use innovative financing, blending donor funds, reinsurance, and capital markets.
Has it proven effective?
Expanded significantly. The rapid payout to Haiti after Hurricane Matthew in 2016 showed its value. It really demonstrates how regional cooperation can build financial resilience.
And the African Risk Capacity, ARC. Similar idea?
Similar, but with a twist. ARC helps African Union members plan for and respond to disasters. Crucially, it links insurance payouts to pre-approved contingency plans. So the money comes, and there's a plan for how to use it effectively.
What triggers their payouts?
They use ARC LTD, their insurance arm, and the Africa Risk View model, sophisticated satellite rainfall data, and crop models to predict drought impacts. Again, much faster response than traditional aid. The 2015-16 Sahel droughts were a key test case. They really emphasize integrating DRF into wider resilience efforts.
It's not just at the national or regional level, though. Cities are doing this.
Yes, city-level resilience. The Greater Miami and the Beaches program is fascinating. Miami faces huge climate risks, obviously.
Hurricanes especially.
Right. They have parametric insurance, triggered by specific hurricane wind speeds. Innovative governance, pre-agreed use of funds for rapid restoration of critical services, collaborative funding across multiple local governments. Jane Gilbert from Miami emphasizes that regional approach. Lots of interest from other vulnerable cities globally.
BRIC comes up again, too, with disaster microinsurance.
Yes, focusing on low-income households' insurance for houses and assets against floods, cyclones. Uses a hybrid index indemnity model parametric triggers combined with simplified local damage assessment. Delivered through their MFI network, tiered premiums, some subsidy for the poorest, reaches over 2 million households, complements the bigger government schemes.
What about catastrophe bonds? Sounds complex.
They are more complex financial instruments. Basically, they transfer disaster risk from a country or entity to global capital markets. Investors buy the bond, they get interest payments, but if a predefined catastrophe happens, like a major earthquake of a certain magnitude, their principal can be used to fund the response.
Issues these for developing countries?
The World Bank has been very active. The Pacific Alliance cap bond for earthquake risk in Chile, Colombia, Mexico, Peru is a big example.
Advantages.
Multi-year protection, accesses huge pools of capital, transparent triggers. Can be cheaper than reinsurance sometimes, though often donor funds help cover issuance costs. Michael Bennett, the World Bank, calls it a paradigm shift. Growing interest in integrating these with other DRF tools.
And the most proactive approach seems to be forecast-based financing, acting before the disaster hit.
Exactly. FBF triggers funding based on forecasts, not impacts. The Red Crescent Movement's forecast-based action, FBA, is a leader here.
How does that work?
Example from Bangladesh. Credible flood forecast hits a certain level, pre-agreed actions are triggered and funded, maybe evacuating people and livestock before the flood arrives, distributing cash or supplies. Made a big difference in the 2020 monsoon floods there. WFP has a similar anticipatory action approach.
So it links forecasting, finance, and operational plans.
Yes. Requires strong science, pre-agreed triggers and plans, and dedicated funding mechanisms like the START Network START Credit Fund. It's really the frontier moving towards prevention.
So across all these DRF innovations, common themes are integration, parametric triggers for speed, layering different tools, blending public and private money, all vital in a changing climate.
Precisely. And underpinning so many of these insurance and DRF innovations is the power of digital technology.
Right. The next section focuses squarely on digital innovation and insurance access. The report makes it clear this is a radical transformation.
It really is. The mobile revolution is ground zero. The sheer explosion of mobile phone ownership, even basic phones, created a platform that just wasn't there before.
BIMA really capitalized on that early on.
Pioneers. Gustav Egertsen from NEMA is quoted, "Mobile was transformative." And we see it everywhere now, mobile insurance for health, life, agriculture, disasters, delivered via apps, USSD menus, SMS.
And it's not just distribution. Tech is making risk assessment smarter.
Definitely. Remote sensing and artificial intelligence. We talked about satellites for agriculture. WorldCover is a great example, using AI to analyze satellite data for assessing crop risk.
Similar things happening in health.
Emerging, yes. Using diverse data sources, mobile usage patterns, purchasing data, maybe even social media data, combined with AI to assess health risks or predict outbreaks. Jimmy Africa in Tanzania, as mentioned, offers huge potential for better pricing and targeting, though also raises data privacy questions.
What about blockchain? Still feels a bit niche, but potential.
Blockchain technology, transparency and automation. The idea of smart contracts automatically executing insurance policies is appealing. Etherisk in Kenya uses it for automated crop insurance payouts based on weather data feeds.
Other examples.
Lemonade used it for flood insurance, parametric payouts. Banco de Bogota for business interruption. WFP explored it for weather risk. Key advantages are transparency. Everyone sees the rules and potentially near instant claims. Still early days for widespread adoption, though.
And the Internet of Things, IoT, sensors everywhere.
Sensors, data, and dynamic insurance. Affordable sensors, soil moisture monitors, water level sensors, even wearables connected to the internet. This allows for prevention-focused insurance.
I like the SweetSense example.
Exactly. Linking soil moisture monitors directly to index insurance policies. The data provides much more granular risk information, potentially leading to more accurate pricing or even dynamic premiums based on measured risk levels. Lots of potential.
But we keep coming back to the digital divide. Not everyone has a smartphone or reliable internet.
A crucial reality, which is why bridging the digital divide, hybrid approaches are so important. Can't assume everyone is digitally connected or literate.
Like Pula using feature phones and QR codes.
Yes. Leveraging simpler tech that people have. Rose Goslinger's quote again. Digital doesn't mean no human touch. Often need agents or community workers equipped with tablets or apps to handle enrollment, explain things, build trust. Vision Fund Microinsure use these hybrid models too, blending digital efficiency with human interaction.
Digital ID is another piece of the puzzle,
right? Yeah, it's a huge enabler. Digital identification, creating economic identities. Lack of formal ID has always been a massive barrier to financial services, including insurance.
India's Aadhaar system is the big example.
Absolutely. It's enabled millions to access services, including insurance schemes like PMJJBY, often linked through Tata, AIG, and others. But even without formal government ID, some platforms create functional economic identities through transaction histories. ACR Africa, Bima do this to some extent. Digital ID unlocks access.
But digital isn't all positive. There are downsides, challenges.
For sure. The challenges of digital insurance are real. The digital divide can worsen inequality if not managed. Algorithmic bias is a risk AI models could inadvertently discriminate or perpetuate existing biases if trained on flawed data.
Regulations lagging behind the tech.
Often, yes. Underdeveloped regulatory frameworks struggle to keep pace. Data privacy and security are massive concerns. How is all this new data being collected, used, protected? And even with lower marginal costs, achieving long-term sustainability for purely digital models can still be tough.
How do we tackle these?
Needs conscious effort. Inclusive design, thinking about users with low literacy or basic phones, proactive regulatory innovation, strong ethical data governance, public-private collaboration, and always keeping a human-centered approach.
So huge potential with digital, but needs careful ethical deployment.
Exactly. Which brings us to the final crucial piece. How do we move beyond individual innovations to building sustainable insurance markets? It's about the whole ecosystem.
Starting with the rules of the game, the regulatory foundation.
Absolutely essential. Traditional insurance regulations often don't fit microinsurance or index insurance well. They can stifle innovation.
So we need specific rules.
Ideally, yes.
Yes.
The Philippines pioneered a dedicated microinsurance framework. Rwanda, Malaysia use regulatory sandboxes to allow testing. The philosophy is balancing consumer protection with the flexibility needed for new markets to grow. Mm. Proactive regulators can actually champion inclusive insurance.
Challenges here.
Limited capacity in some regulatory bodies. That's where regional networks like A2II, the Access to Insurance Initiative, are valuable, sharing knowledge and best practice.
And alongside enabling rules, we need strong consumer protection, especially for vulnerable customers.
Paramount. When dealing with people new to insurance, low financial literacy, the risks are higher. Information asymmetry, power imbalances, behavioral biases that can lead to poor choices.
So what does good consumer protection look like here?
Simplified, standardized information disclosure is key. Clear standards for product value ensuring policies aren't junk. Accessible, easy-to-use complaint mechanisms. Market monitoring by regulators.
Are companies doing this themselves too?
Some market leaders are. BIMA's customer surveys, their goodwill fund for borderline claims, ACRE Africa's community meetings for feedback. Tech Connect 2 verification apps, SMS access to policy details. It's about finding that balance, robust safeguards without stifling the market. Ongoing collaboration is needed.
You can have the best rules and products, but if people don't understand insurance,
it won't stick. Ooh. Building insurance literacy is foundational for sustainable demand. Insurance is abstract.
Is traditional financial education effective?
Often limited impact. The report highlights more innovative approaches. R4's simulation games where people experience risk and insurance decisions. CARD MBA using peer educators from the community. Pioneer Life using visual storytelling.
What makes these work better?
Relevance to people's lives. Good timing teaching when it matters. Repetition. Peer learning showing concrete outcomes. And it's not just customers, distributors. Community leaders need literacy, too. Public campaigns like Nigeria's InsureAware help. Digital platforms offer new channels. Investing in understanding is core to market development.
Okay, the big one. Balancing commercial viability with social impact. Always tricky.
The perennial challenge. Early projects were often donor-heavy. Purely commercial approaches sometimes struggled to reach the poorest or provide real value. True sustainability needs both financial health and meaningful customer value.
How do successful players manage it?
Cross-subsidization sometimes. Relentless focus on operational efficiency, using tech smartly. Process innovation often requires patient capital that understands long-term market building. Scale helps enormously. Strong operational discipline. Appropriate capital structures.
What kinds of organizations are achieving this balance?
Diverse models. Specialized providers like Bima or Microinsure. Mutual cooperatives like CardMBA or Uplift. Some innovative insurtechs. Well-structured public-private partnerships. There's no single answer.
What about subsidies? Are they always bad?
Not necessarily, but they need to be smart. The role of subsidies and smart support is key. Some segments might just need help to access insurance.
So smart subsidies don't create dependency.
That's the goal. Target specific barriers. Examples: subsidizing infrastructure like weather stations, Rwanda. Supporting R&D, ILO's impact insurance facility. Time-limited premium subsidies for early adopters, Kenya crop insurance. Targeting specific vulnerable groups, Philippines, PhilHealth. Even outcome-based subsidies, Peru's Fogata.
Principles for good subsidies.
Transparency, market-conforming design. Clear goals and metrics, coordination, adaptive management, and requires government capacity to design them well.
And building a market means strengthening everyone involved.
Yes, building capacity across the ecosystem. Insurers need specific skills. Distributors need training. Regulators need specialized knowledge. Support services, tech vendors, researchers need to understand the context. And customers need literacy. It's all interconnected. Needs a coordinated ecosystem approach.
Finally, how do we know if we're succeeding? It's not just about policy numbers, is it?
Definitely not. Measuring success beyond coverage numbers is crucial. We need to look at inclusion breadth, how many, but also inclusion depth, quality of cover, client value, real benefits, and financial performance, sustainability.
Are there tools for this?
Innovative research like the ILO's client math, Insight 2 Impact's segmentation analysis, they give a much richer picture than just counting policies. Helps distinguish genuine market development from superficial growth.
So it feels like we're moving from exciting pilots to the harder work of building entire sustainable markets.
That's a great summary. Shifting from pioneering innovation to systematic market development needs progress on all these fronts simultaneously. And it takes time, patience, and keeping the focus on expanded protection and resilience for vulnerable people.
Well, this has been an incredibly rich, deep dive. For you, the learner, listening in, I hope we've managed to unpack how these really innovative insurance models, often powered by tech but always tailored locally, are starting to make real inroads in bridging that huge insurance gap in developing economies.
Yeah, addressing those unique risks we talked about and really helping to foster economic growth and resilience at the grassroots level.
Some of those examples, like the speed of mobile money claims or that insurance for work idea in Ethiopia, they really stick with you as practical ways to solve tough problems.
Definitely. And hopefully you had some of those aha moments, seeing the ingenuity involved in overcoming these complex challenges and grasping the potential for real societal impact.
Absolutely. And look, this deep dive, it's really just scratching the surface, isn't it?
Oh, completely. It's such a rapidly evolving field. There are countless other examples, nuances, ongoing experiments. We really encourage you to keep exploring this area if it's sparked your interest.
And maybe a final thought to leave you with. Could the lessons being learned here, the innovations being pioneered in these often challenging environments in developing economies, could they actually offer insights for us in higher income nations too? As we face our own new and evolving risks, maybe there are approaches here we could adapt to address our own protection gaps and build more resilient communities.
That's a really interesting question to ponder. Food for thought.